My name is Ed Goldberg, and as I adjust the microphone, I have the pleasure of speaking with Kat Richardson. Kat, welcome back to Portland.
Oh, thanks for having me again, Ed.
Okay. Well, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. This is the title of your latest book is Vanished. Kat is spelled with a K, Kat Richardson, and it's published by, what's ROC?
Rock. They're a subdivision of Penguin.
Okay. Gotcha. Yeah, I used to be a Penguin writer. But that's in another life. Let me tell you a little bit about Kat. Kat Richardson is an American author, known for her Grey Walker urban fantasy series. We'll talk about Grey Walkers in a minute. Kat is a former theater brat. That's something I didn't know about you. A nonfiction editor who currently lives on a boat in Washington State with her husband and the ghosts of ferrets, alas. We'll talk about ferrets also. You ride a motorcycle, you shoot target pistol, and you make trouble. Are you still a troublemaker?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, as often as possible.
Okay, good for you. I appreciate that. You helped develop a fan-built PC game, wrote a short horror screenplay. Did it ever get produced?
Yeah, but it was a very small production, and I actually don't have a copy of it. Isn't
that's
that
pretty
sad?
Amazing. In this day and age, you don't have a copy. No. You taught English country dance.
Yeah.
Hey, Nani Nani, okay. You fenced with an épée. You broke both arms, not at the same time, I presume.
No, different times.
Different times. And different arms.
Yes, okay. One each.
One each. You wrote about diamonds. You ate alligator. I've done that. Cajun restaurants always serve alligator.
It was dead at the time, so it's
excellent.
Not as exciting as it
yeah.
sounds.
You sold dead lizards. We don't explain about that.
That was a Renaissance Fair gig.
Okay.
Someone
so you're
had
saying like Eye of Newt and stuff like that? Or
no, it was really just a lizard, and it had died by accident. And to object to its sad and sudden death... we were carrying it around, attempting to sell it to people and tell them the horrible story of how the awful thing had died. It was surprising how many people wanted to buy a dead lizard on a string.
Sounds like a state fair. You probably should have deep-fried it and put it on a stick. you pretended to be a nun?
Yeah. I was in high school. We did musical productions every year, and I was a nun in the nuns' chorus of The Sound of Music.
Mm-hmm.
And because our, not the choral director, but the chorus director, the person who was in charge specifically of the chorus on stage, was kind of a jerk, we decided to go against his direct orders and go out in our costumes. And so we went out to buy ice cream and tried to persuade the guy who was selling us the ice cream that we were real nuns.
He didn't buy it.
Actually, he did.
He did, yeah. Who tells a nun you're lying,
yeah,
sister?
He had never seen a real nun, and so he had no idea.
Oh, God. Okay. If he was a Catholic schoolboy, you would have been toast.
No. We were safe.
Let's see now. Let's talk about your book. We'll talk about the California ferret legislation later, whatever that. Remind me to ask about that.
Okay.
Title of the book is Vanished, and this is another in the series of books featuring Harper Blaine.
Yeah, it's number four.
Number four. Now, the thing about Harper Blaine is that... theoretically, it's just a private eye. This should be just a private eye novel.
Yeah.
Yes. However, there's other stuff going on. She died once, for example. Tell us how she died and what resulted from that.
excuse me.
Yeah.
Well, they started off as private eye novels. That's what I wanted to do. In the first two pages of the first book, I killed her off. She was beaten to death by a man she was investigating. And she came back. You know, she was only dead for 2 minutes. And when she came back, she could see ghosts and magic, which kind of looks like electrical conduits. And they could, unfortunately, see her. So all the ghosts and monsters who have problems in Seattle start bringing their problems to her. You know, you need an investigator. Who are you going to call? And it turns out to be poor Harper.
Yeah.
She has a real hard time accepting what she's seeing initially. She thinks she's either hallucinating or gone crazy. Eventually, she figures it out, and by book four, she's working for monsters, vampires, witches, ghosts.
They're just clients,
They're annoying clients is what they are. They have a tendency to show up whenever they want. They're very imperious. You know, they
or
threaten
not show
to kill you.
They want.
Yeah.
Show up out of nowhere whenever they want.
Yeah, it's kind of like working for the mafia. When they show up, you say, yes, okay.
Uh-huh. I was curious about, this is the second of your books that I've read, and we talked about one of your earlier books, Underground, I think is the one we talked about.
Yeah, that was book three.
Book three. And is there a story arc here? Do you have some kind of idea of where you want these stories to go? Is just each book more or less a standalone within Harper Blaine's
life?
Yeah,
there's an initial five-book arc, books one through five, and I'm working on number five right now.
Mm-hmm.
They all kind of hang together by the time you get to book five. We're going to tie off a bunch of stuff. And when I say we, I mean me and my editor, because she beats me soundly. No, she doesn't. She's sweet. But she stays on me about continuity and, you know, tying off all the little threads that I've left hanging throughout the series. And that was the intention from the beginning, was to create an initial arc that in this case ended up being five books long. And when that is done, we'll start either a new arc, depending on the contract, or a standalone.
Uh-huh. And when you say standalone, would that feature somebody beyond, besides Harper Blaine?
No, that would be just Harper. If they contracted for six total, mm-hmm. In two contracts. And so each contract was three, but I had only got five stories together. So book six was referred to as, it was the Red Harvest with Ghosts, was how we summarized it to my editor.
For those of you who don't know Raymond Chandler, is Red Harvest is one of his stories?
Dashiell Hammett.
Dashiell Hammett, I'm sorry.
Yeah, Continental Op.
You may beat me later for that. Egregious error.
The ghost of Dash will come for you.
He will. As long as he doesn't send what's-her-name after me, that's okay.
Oh, Lillian Hellman.
Lillian Hellman, yeah. Because she'd know where to poke.
Oh, yeah.
Something I noticed about this book is you become an Anglophile. I don't know if you always were, but you are deeply enmeshed in London and England in this book as Harper goes there in pursuit of this case.
Well, there's a couple of reasons for that. I'm married to a guy who was raised in England,
uh-huh.
and I've never been there before, so we went last year. Also, part of the initial idea for the whole series came from a British television series which aired in England as Randall and Hopkirk Deceased. And it was about a pair of kind of low-rent private investigators living in London. And one of them dies in a car accident, which turns out not to be an accident. And so he haunts his partner into solving his murder. And then he won't go away. And he keeps showing up and pestering his partner to take on all these weird cases. And he is just an annoying ghost. And I thought, what if the ghost was the client? And, you know, you were the partner who keeps seeing this ghost. And that's part of what kicked the series into being. You know, a lot of other things came together, but that was one of the things. So it seemed appropriate to go to England at some point, since there had been some strong inspiration there. Incidentally, that show was aired in the United States as My Partner the Ghost.
Mm-hmm.
They've remade it since then, and I don't think that it's anywhere near as good as the original version that came out in like 1976 and was very, very goofy and low budget and just silly as heck.
Like the ghost, old Doctor Who
yeah,
used to
the
be.
Ghost wore a white suit, and that's how you knew someone was dead, was they wore white. Never okay, after
that,
Labor
that
Day.
That works, you know. Oh, yeah, John Waters would get after you for that. If you remember one of his movies, somebody was killed and it was okay because she wore white shoes after Labor Day.
Yeah, she was wearing white shoes after Labor Day. Right. I remember that.
I'm an Anglophile, have been since I was a kid. I was really amused to see how deeply you'd gotten into English culture. Even as you throw out English slang. You one of your characters, Marsden, who's another Grey Walker, is a lower class, I guess. I don't know if he's a Cockney, but he's certainly a lower-class English guy. And
well, Marsden's an interesting guy because although he's been living in London for quite a long time, like probably 80 or 90 years, he's a lot older than he looks. He's actually born in Norfolk, which is where my husband grew up. And uh-huh. So I adopted the accent and speech patterns of his stepfather, who's born and bred, dyed-in-the-wool Norfolkman. They have a very unusual way of speaking. It's very old-fashioned. It's strange constructions like they bain't and so on. I had a lovely time sticking those in, and my English friends all recognize him. They're like, oh, he's from Norfolk. And I say, yeah, by way of London and almost everywhere else. So I got to play around with it quite a bit. Luckily, you know, with the husband's family and with friends and my editor in England, I had a lot of help keeping everybody's language straight, making sure I didn't put my foot very deeply in my mouth. I got a nice review recently from an English writer saying that she was very impressed with how good my English research was.
Yeah, well, as a you know, a hopeless Anglophile, I was impressed with how well you did it. And so,
thank you.
Good job. And it never looked like research. That was the best thing about it.
That's a great thing about writing these books is I'm one of those research and history fiends. I've always loved that kind of stuff. And so I get to go and dig around in strange places and read weird books and interview people and turn it into something that I enjoy and hopefully other people enjoy. And then I write it off my taxes.
Superb. That's the only real reward you get for being a writer, because not much else comes your way these days.
But it is a good reward.
Except for the ardor and adulation of your fans.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
And you have a lot of those, so I know that. One of the things I think about when I think about these books, let's talk about what a gray walker is, because I know there are people who might not have heard our first interview. Was it last year, 2 years ago?
Oh, it was last year.
Last year. And may be interested in what's going on here, because we are living in a resurgence of the undead in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
There's vampires and death eaters and heaven knows what else floating around these days. So what's a gray walker?
Well, in this case, it's something I made up. Greywalkers are people who can physically enter the plane in between the living and the dead. It's the place where magic exists. It's the place where all the things that are kind of half a monster and half a human are. It's where ghosts hang out because they're dead, but they haven't quite disappeared. It's also where the magic is visible. And like I said, it kind of looks like electrical conduit or, you know, neon. There's a lot of different visual tricks going on, and after a while, you know, the Grey Walker sorts out what they're seeing and what it is and what they can do with it. And every Grey Walker has slightly different abilities, as Marsden reveals. They all have the same basic ability to go and hang out in this weird place, which is called the Grey, and then they can manipulate it in various ways or not, depending on what they're good at. And that's how she gets involved with all these strange clients.
Mm-hmm. One thing I've learned from Marx Brothers films is that no matter how bizarre you make the universe, if it's consistent within itself, people will buy it.
Oh, yeah.
So if the Marxes make everything so loony, but the looniness works from minute to minute in the mm-hmm. film, everybody just goes along with it.
Yeah.
Do you work hard to keep yourself consistent? Is there some trick you use to make sure that things don't fly apart and get weird?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, first I set it as much in the real world as possible, and then I just add the strange stuff on top. And I constructed a lot of the magical system based on some kind of far out there physics, mostly quantum physics and a little bit of particle physics. And then, you know, threw a little of the metaphysics that comes out of that on top, and then, you know, warped it slightly. So I've got someone else's rules to work with. I know how certain things work, and that's the way it's always going to be. I also keep track. I have what I call the series Bible, and it's this humongous file on my computer that says, this person does this, and that's like that, and this color means this, and this person died, in this year, and this person is related to that person in this way, and it's long and boring. I can't imagine anyone but me wanting to read it, but I do keep track.
Well, you might want to publish it later, like J.K. Rowling did with her notes about something or other that for Harry Potter.
Well, if I'm ever as big a seller as J.K. Rowling, I could, you know, probably sell my laundry list.
Yeah, that's true. Well, of all the people I know who write, you're one of the people who deserves it most, so
oh,
I hope that
you.
Happens. Me too, but that's beside the point. Let me remind our listeners, and I'm speaking with Kat Richardson, first name K-A-T. The title of the book is Vanished, and is published by Rock, R-O-C. What gets Harper to England? Now, she's working for Edward. Edward is a vampire.
Yeah.
And as you say, it's gotten to the point now where these things that used to scare the hell out of her have just become clients now. Mm-hmm. So tell us what goes
she
on.
She still has a healthy respect and fear of some of these guys, because they can wipe her out. She has to play a balancing game with them. But yeah, first she gets a phone call from a dead guy, and she goes off to look into her past. And while she's doing that, she gets a phone call from Edward, who is the head vampire in Seattle. And he says, I have a problem, and you are the only person who can address this. I need you to go to London. And she's kind of reluctant to go initially because she doesn't like being ordered around and manipulated. But he makes her a pretty good deal. You know, it's not quite an offer you can't refuse, but it's pretty close.
Mm-hmm.
And she has an ulterior motive anyhow. There's an old friend is in London, and she's been having these nightmares, and so she thinks, well, I'll check on that while I'm there.
It's one of the Novak brothers. It's Will, I guess.
Yeah, Will Novak, who's an ex-boyfriend. Boy, there's a lot of ex-boyfriends.
The ghost who calls her, Clay Malloy, isn't he also an
Carrie's her...
Carrie Malloy, yeah.
Yeah, Carrie's her ex-boyfriend, and there's some interesting complications about good old Carrie.
Women of a certain age have to have a certain number of ex-boyfriends, don't they? It just works out that way.
Well, you know, I thought, you know, everybody, unless they meet the great love of their life when they're in junior high school, they've had past relationships with various people. And especially when you're kind of a locked down person like Harper is, she's not the most open person in the world. You've probably had a lot of failed relationships because you didn't, you know, give up yourself to your significant other at some point, and they got resentful and said, you don't love me enough to tell me who you really are, you know, or how come you won't go to my play, or how come you don't like my friends, or whatever. And then your relationship falls apart. So I figured she's gotten to be 35 by this book. She's had a lot of failed relationships.
Well, we get to know a little bit of why that is, because we meet her mother.
Oh, goodness, yes.
Yeah, okay, wait, tell us now about getting her to England. What does Edward want her to do?
Edward has obviously kind of a long past, and he hasn't always been in the United States. He's older than the United States. So he had to come from somewhere, and he has kind of his financial comptroller in London, the guy who's managing what's left of his financial business, has disappeared.
Is this Purcell?
Purcell, yeah. It's spelled Purcell, but it's pronounced Purcell.
In England, it's Purcell.
It is.
Like the composer.
He's named after a friend of mine who pronounces it Purcell, but he did point out that it's Purcell in England. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of fun. And Purcell has disappeared, and we don't know why, but it's important to Edward to find out what's happening because he suspects that there's something very big and very deep going on. He's also facing a lot of trouble at home in Seattle where things are kind of falling apart. And so he thinks this is all possibly part and parcel of the same thing. And he turns out to be right. So he sends Harper to investigate London because he obviously cannot go himself. He needs to stay in Seattle and deal with business there.
Rumblings of discord in the vampire community?
Oh, considerable. And there's a lot of interesting factions going on. In the first book, I established that vampires are kind of like a wolf pack in that whoever is top dog stays top dog only as long as he keeps on showing his teeth. As soon as he looks weak, someone will knock him off. Mm-hmm. And so you're constantly having to put down all the people who want to take a chunk out of you and take over the pack. It's part of the reason I don't really deal with werewolves is that I kind of rolled a certain amount of the mythology of vampires and werewolves together. Also, I can't come up with a good physics explanation for shapeshifters.
I don't know. There must be a quantum mechanics explanation for that. I mean, there's co-location.
Well, we got into it a little bit in the third book where there's an explanation for why it wouldn't work, and then there's an explanation for how it might work. Mm-hmm. And my fans now send me letters, you know, trying to explain their version of the science for how, you know, shape-shifting does actually work, which is cool.
Yes.
It's like I have, you know, thousands and thousands of little researchers out there doing stuff for me.
I know you blog. Do you get a lot of responses to your blogs?
Actually, I only get moderate response to blogs. I don't have a huge internet fan base. A lot of my fans are actually, you know, closer to my age. They're in their 30s and 40s. And a lot of the people who interact most strongly with blogs are in their 20s and early 30s. So until
Website? Tell people your website that they can look at it.
It's www.catrichardson.com. Oh, very original of me.
Why should it be anything else but that?
Yeah, well, I now have a Facebook and I Twitter and
Twitter?
Yeah, I know.
Ew.
It's awful.
I know. Have you ever had an experience that you would consider to be otherworldly, what's the word, extrasensory or anything like that?
When I was a kid, we had a strange thing happen where we lived in an area where there was no swamp gas, but this kind of ghostly, scary, you know, will-o'-the-wisp seemed to come into the room and look kind of ghostly to us. There's a million explanations for what it could be or couldn't be, but it stays with me as something kind of weird. And of course, like most people, I've had that, did I just see something out of the corner of my eye sensation that everyone does, and those strange sensations and kind of half dreams that you have just as you're falling asleep, and all of that stuff sort of, you know, hangs together. I'm not sure whether any of it is supernatural or not, but it makes great fodder for the what if, you know.
Yeah, I saw a ghost cat once. I'm convinced of that.
A ghost cat?
Ghost cat, yeah. I was living in a house of friends of mine. They were moving, and they had a cat.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, haven't you taken Millie out of the house yet? She said, oh, Millie's back in the new house. I said, what's that? Oh, that's the ghost cat.
Wow.
Because they had seen it as well. Yeah. So. Also, I have this thing where a friend, a relative, will be in my mind for 3 or 4 days, and then they'll call. It's like I'm anticipating their call.
Yeah, there's all kinds of interesting stories out there. And being a little bit of a skeptic, I'm not inclined to swallow anything until someone can show me some proof. But there's an awful lot of kind of weird, spooky stuff out there in human experience. You know, the phone call from someone that you've been thinking about, or, you know, the ghost cat. I actually think that cats probably have a secret doorway, because I know that when I had cats, they would appear in the room out of nowhere. They would disappear. They would get outside. They would find things that were unfindable. They would lose things that were unlosable. And I'm pretty sure that cats just carry around their own personal tesseract.
I was once married to a woman who thought that Siamese cats were from another planet. So,
and they might be.
They might be. Let's get back to one of the characters in the book in England is an evil presence who is called Alice Liddell, of all things, who was the Alice from Alice in Wonderland that Charles Dodgson wrote about.
I actually discussed that a little bit in the book. Yeah, she adopted the name. And whether or not she is the real Alice is entirely up to you to decide. Probably not. But, you know, when you've been hanging around for hundreds of years, you have to change your identification every once in a while. And if you're kind of an obnoxious, I hate to use the word, an unpleasant individual of the female variety, you might decide as a joke to call yourself after someone that we all think of as very sweet. Like Alice.
Little Orphan Annie or something.
Or Little Orphan Annie, yeah. In the first book, when we first met Alice, she's kind of a villain in the first book and continues to be a villain in the fourth book. At one point she says, yeah, that's my name because Alice B. Toklas was taken.
Oh, yes. That's very funny. You're all right.
Thank you.
Seattle is Harper's home base, and Seattle is teeming with people in the gray world in the gray side, and as is London, which is a city which is very ancient. You know, it's been around at least since Roman times.
Oh, yeah,
and at various points in the book, Harper can see ghosts going as far back as the Fire of London, and even back earlier than that.
Yeah, there's a very short moment where she sees a bunch of Roman soldiers walking along the bank of the Fleet River. Because they did have an encampment on the fleet at one point.
Yeah,
she can see all kinds of strange and creepy things, and sometimes they're desperately out of context or kind of moved away from their physical location by various, you know, devices of the gray.
It seems that Pioneer Square is a PowerPoint or a nexus or something in
Pioneer
Seattle.
Pioneer Square is an interesting place because although it's not actually where Seattle started, it's the first place they developed it all. And it used to be a landfill now. It used to be a mud flat. And there's all kinds of interesting things about the history of Pioneer Square. And it's the oldest part of Seattle that's still standing pretty much the way it was, about 120 years ago. So it makes a great place to dig down into history because history isn't very far below the surface there.
Mm-hmm. Getting back to England and Harper's quest in England, all detective writers like to put their protagonists into some kind of peril.
Regularly.
Regularly, yes. And you know, it's a guy with a gun. It's a treacherous client. It's
Femme fatale.
Femme fatales, except in case of the femme fatales here, most of them really are fatale. You know, they're long gone.
They're dead by the end of the book. In my case, they were dead at the beginning.
Have you found this? What would you call it? An expanded palette of doom? Do you find that fun to work with?
Oh yeah, it's wonderful. I can introduce all kinds of horrible things. That there were ancient Indian gods running around in the third book.
Yes,
there were. Ghosts and other horrible things in the second book. There were all kinds of awful things in the first book. You know, there were necromancers and ghosts who just wouldn't lie down and give it up, and horrible objects that threaten people in weird ways. Yeah, it's a whole extra set of creepy things, but they still fulfill the same roles as a classic detective antagonist.
Do you ever get to... I've got to phrase this right because I don't want to mislead the response. But do you ever think I really need to throw in a wild card here because I'm getting too complacent about what I'm writing? I'm getting too good at it, or it seems to come too easily.
They never come easy. Every time I think this book's going to be easy, I am dead wrong. I thought the last book was going to be easy. Nope. I thought the current manuscript was going to be easy, and so far it is a beast, and I wrestle with it every night for a couple of thousand words, and it usually wins, and I don't. I do want to challenge myself and write a better book every time, and that means that I'm constantly looking for something that's harder. Okay, I did that. Let's do something new. And it's not just, can I come up with a new monster? It's, can I do a better job? Can I write something from a more difficult perspective? Can I throw in a complication that is harder to manage? Can I put in a character type that I've never dealt with before? That kind of thing. The work in progress actually starts from someone else's point of view, and I realized I haven't written anything in the third-person point of view literally in years. And I had kind of forgotten how, and it took quite a while to, you know, get those chops back in shape. So that was interesting.
Yeah.
And now I'm tying off a lot of threads from the first four books in the fifth book, The Work in Progress. And I forgot things and had to go back and reread everything and say, oh, that's what that was. And how am I going to deal with that? That was bad, without doing what the science fiction people call retconning. A retcon where you go back and you change the facts retroactively.
Oh, yes.
I can't do that because fans have these incredible memories. They remember everything you ever did. You know, like that that classic joke about Star Trek fans who ask William Shatner questions about, well, in episode 23 when you said, it's like, I don't know. I was an actor. I got paid by the day.
Yeah, they keep asking Paul Giamatti why he doesn't like Merlot. You know, he's like, I don't know anything about wine. That was my character. Merlot. Yeah.
Yeah.
When you reread that first book, did anything make you cringe? Did you say, oh, my God?
Oh, everything.
Yeah.
I looked at it and went, oh, awful. Oh, terrible. Oh, now I understand all those bad reviews.
This is a very common thing, and because most writers will get better from book to book, just from the practice, I mean, if nothing else.
Yeah.
And you begin to absorb the good habits and, you know, lay waste to the bad ones, mm-hmm. and the first book always makes you just...
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of things that if I had the opportunity to go back and rewrite that book, I would make a lot of changes. Of course, then it would be a totally different book. There's some things about it that, in spite of my being clumsy, I think were still pretty good. But I do cringe when I read it and go, oh, no. Oh, Kat, you bad girl.
I know you're working on the fifth book. You've just been talking about that. And there's the sixth book in the offing. Do you have any idea what that's going to be about, or don't you think that far ahead?
Except for the kind of broad, you know, synopsis description that I, like I said, you know, Red Harvest with Ghosts. Mm-hmm. No, I haven't gotten a lot further. I have a vague setting in mind and a couple of specific types of monster I'd like to throw in. And other than that, no.
You should bring her down to Portland.
And I would like
in the
to.
Shanghai tunnels, you know, the yeah. Shanghai tunnels would be rife with the ghosts of haunted sailors, you know.
Yeah, yeah, dead sailors.
Dead
and,
sailors,
you know,
yeah.
People who've been thunked over the head with a heavy piece of wood.
And drugged.
Yeah, not to mention all the Chinese who were probably, you know, kicked in a hole when they had too much opium or, mm-hmm. you know, someone had worked them to death doing something.
I always invite people to write about Portland because
yeah.
Portland has its, I mean, just, you know, it's like Seattle in a way. It has a mm-hmm. similar history.
Yeah.
And it has that same spooky, they were here before us passed, you know.
And it's a marvelous town historically. And I would love to. And I've now managed to get Harper out of Seattle twice. You know, she went to London and I did a novella that was published in January in a collection called Mean Streets. And she went to Oaxaca during El Dia de los Muertos in order...
Perfect.
Yeah, to see a grave and, you know, do something there. And things went deeply, deeply wrong.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you. I've been speaking with Kat Richardson, K-A-T. The title of the book is Vanished. It's published by Rock, R-O-C. We eagerly anticipate your next book.
Why, thank you.